It's my first time here, so very nice to see you all. And so I heard that you had been looking at the refuge tree, which is this. Yeah, is that right?
Okay, good.
So I thought we could just continue exploring what the refuge tree means tonight. So I thought maybe I'll probably say a bit, but it won't be a formal talk. I'll be asking you things as well. And I thought, I think you've been looking at some of the individual figures from the refuge tree, but I thought we'd take a step right back and just try and look at the tree as a whole and what it means for us and our lives. Well, we say kind of for short the refuge tree, kind of more properly it's the tree of refuge and respect, even reverence, the tree of refuge and respect, or even tree of refuge and reverence. So, well, maybe I'll start off with asking you something. what strikes you, you know, when you immediately look at that picture of the tree of refuge and respect, what immediately strikes you about it?
The symmetry.
The symmetry, yeah. Can you say any more about women? It is symmetrical.
Mm. It's quite balanced.
Yeah.
And symmetrical, and it's sort of, I suppose, you know, symmetry is beauty and balance.
Yeah. It is, and I think, that's actually been striking me more and more about the tree, the sort of symmetry of it. And of course, we've got, it's a picture, so it's in two dimensions. But I always think, we should almost build it in three dimensions, because that's, it really is in three dimensions. You've got the Buddha in the middle on the lotus, and then you've got these four lotuses to the front, to the back, to either side. So what we see at the bottom is actually the front, and then you've got the either side, and then behind the Dharma books, and then you've got more levels above, and the whole thing set in blue sky. So I think you've got a symmetry in different ways. You've got a sort of horizontal symmetry, as it were, because I think I especially noticed that with these figures here, they're the archetypal bodhisattvas. So they're they're eternal figures. They're always depicted as 16 years old. And what that means is that really they're outside time. And then you've got, on the other side, you've got the arahants, the Buddha's actual living disciples, you know, who were alive. And they're all, they're within time, so they're all, they're not so youthful. They show the signs of age, they're dressed in rags and so on. So I think, you've got very lovely symmetry there, where you can, like, one without the other wouldn't work. You know, if you just had the sort of historical figures, you'd be missing this dimension of beauty and archetype. But if you just had the archetype without the real people practicing, it wouldn't be complete. So you've got symmetry there. I think you've got sort of vertical symmetry as well, because you've got the Buddha, and then the five Buddha mandala at the top, and then Vajrasattva at the very top. Vajrasattva sometimes said he's kind of the last thing in the blue sky, any kind of more refined, and he'd be blue sky. He's like the last thing you see before everything disappears in the blue sky. I'm sort of speaking poetically. And what I've been more and more thinking, again, this isn't literally true, but it is kind of true, it's poetically true, is that we're in the picture as well. Like, I know we're not literally drawn in the picture, but we're the refugees in relation to us. So there's a sort of vertical symmetry. So because we're, we engage with it by, well, we engage with it by looking at it, but actually this isn't just a picture to be looked at. It's like traditionally this you would be again and again like bowing, even prostrating before this picture. It's before the picture isn't quite right. You could use the picture as an aid to be visualising all these figures, and you'd be bowing again and again, even prostrating before them. So sort of weird in the picture as well. So there's that sort of vertical symmetry as well. So what else do you notice as well as its symmetry? What's the most immediate thing? If you'd never seen it before, what would you sort of think when you saw it?
Almost one big sort of lotus flower, and then the flowers at the bottom, and then you've got all the characters higher up, sort of.
Yeah, there's one big one in the middle,
yes,
isn't there? Yeah, and who's all, and that's the Buddha, isn't it? So you've got the Buddha right in the middle, so, and then you've got all these other ones. So, I mean, the thing I would notice about it is it's very, very abundant, isn't it? And you've had talks on the different figures. There's loads of figures. It's a very rich symbol. It's kind of ample. It's kind of got everything in it. So you've got this this very rich symbol. It's got this. It's symmetrical, and it's an aid to our imaginations, and it's used in the practice of reverence. It's used in the. It's something you would bow before, just as we bow before the shrine, you bow before this, even prostrate before it. So the traditional practice that comes from the Tibetan tradition is called the going for refuge and prostration practice, where you would be like gazing at this picture that in order to conjure up all the figures in your imagination, you'd be bowing, even prostrating before them. So it's the practice, it's to spark off the practice of reverence in us. So I want to say a bit, I want us to now talk a bit more about reverence in general, because that's what I think of when I look at this tree. And I want to talk about a particular Buddha sutta. So suttas are collections of the early teachings of Buddhism. And there's a particular sutta called the Garava Sutta. Has anyone heard of the Garava Sutta? You have? Yeah. Good. Well, I'm glad you haven't heard of it, because that gives me the chance to tell you about it. So the Garava Sutta is set at the time just after the enlightenment of the Buddha. So are people familiar with the story of the enlightenment of the Buddha? Yeah, most of you. Yeah. So the Buddha, as we know, was a born an ordinary human being. Through his own efforts, realized this state, if you like, that we call enlightenment, and that happened underneath what we now call the Bodhi tree. So he'd been on this whole quest. Which we'll need to save for another talk, the whole journey of the quest. So this, he'd been on this whole quest that eventually led him to this tree, and he sat down under this tree with great determination. Does anybody know what he said as he sat, just as he sat underneath the tree?
He wouldn't move
any. That's exactly what he said, and he said it in very strong terms. He said, "Flesh may wither away, blood may dry up, but I'm not going to move from this spot till I gain enlightenment." So very, very strong determination. And he did. He realised enlightenment under the tree. And then he didn't just kind of, you know, jump up and kind of, you know, get on with the rest of his life. He stayed under that tree, well, tradition says for 7 weeks. It's probably not literally 7 weeks, but seven's a kind of magic number. So he stayed under this tree for 7 weeks. And had all different occurrences happened then. You know, he was absorbing the experience, more reflections were happening. Enlightenment was becoming more and more complete. In a sense, that's probably quite a good way to think of it, that the enlightenment is something decisive, but it's not an end point. In one sense, it's never completed. It is decisive. There's no going back. There's no longer, at enlightenment, you no longer want to fall back into greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's decisive. It's never again will you, you know, never again will you experience hatred, for example, not even a tiny bit. So it's decisive, but at the same time, it's not like a full stop. There's continual unfolding and creativity can flow on from that. And so under the tree, more and more things were happening that were completing this experience of enlightenment. And what's described in this Garbha Sutta is the newly enlightened Buddha. I always imagine that, you know, if you were watching, what you'd see is a sort of instinct to look up, almost the kind of, like, how did that happen? Like, where, you know, something amazing's happened, and, you know, that instinct to look up when something like that happens. So he's sort of looking up, and a sort of thought, it's probably not a thought as we think, because, you know, he's in this very, very kind of subtle state of consciousness, but something like a thought occurs, like, oh, who am I going to revere? Who is there in this universe to revere? And interestingly, what the sutta says is it says that what occurred to the Buddha was to live without reverence is suffering. Who am I going to revere? Because to live without reverence is suffering. So what do you think of that? Do you think that's... is that true? Is to live without reverence suffering? Or you think you could...
Well, I can connect with that if I think reverence like a sort of inspiration. Because,
mm-hmm.
I don't know, reverence... I don't know. It's a strange word for me.
Yeah. What does it kind of...
Well, I guess I don't know. I see it like... well, because I was brought up as a Catholic, and then at some point, you know, when I was a teenager, sort of, you know, broke up with that.
Mm.
It's like, I don't know, you know, and I've lived all my life like very sort of agnostic and everything. Mm. I don't know.
There's a bit of reverence might be a bit naive or something, or a bit.
No, is it naive? Oh, maybe. It's interesting because I don't know what is.
Yeah.
What is
something
it?
To be a bit wary of.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't think.
But at the same time,
yeah,
I completely understand it because you know, as I said. You know, inspiration is something that I connect more with, and that, you know, there are people that I, you know, I can admire very much people and feel, you know, like grateful and all that, and I guess that's reverence.
Yeah, I think reverence and gratitude are very, very closely connected, yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's, you know, a sort of condition against the word.
I'm not surprised to hear that you, and I'm sure others either here or certainly elsewhere, have a response of, well, I'm not really sure about this reference, because wrongly applied, it's not a very good idea, really, you know. So at the same time, it's interesting you're connecting it with inspiration and gratitude, and also open to how we might look at it a bit differently as Buddhists, which is hopefully what we'll keep exploring tonight, yeah. Yeah, so thanks. How about other people with this, like, to live without reference is suffering? Is that...
Yeah, definitely chimes with me.
It chimes with you?
Thinking about... an enlightened being thinking that is like quite hard to fit inside my head.
Yeah. So why is that? Say more.
Well, I guess for me, you know, it's partly connected to how I can progress and who I can learn from.
Yeah.
And I guess it links to what you said about enlightenment not being like a full stop, but there's still space for creativity and development. Because actually, if there isn't, then it sounds like a kind of hell in a way, like if it's just a destination.
Yeah.
And so, I guess it's even more exploring in dimensions we can't even imagine.
I think that's exactly it. And it is, it's very, very surprising thing for a Buddha to say, isn't it? I mean, we might think, oh yeah, we might, you know, we're still growing and developing and we, you know, we look up to people and so on, but for a Buddha who's actually enlightened to still feel that to live without reverence is suffering, it's surprising.
Yeah.
But yeah, it does connect with the it's not a full stop.
And I guess thinking of like us kind of saluting the shrine, like who does the shrine salute in a way?
That's exactly the right question. So who does the shrine salute? So that's interesting. So what was interesting in the case of the Buddha was his instinct was to look for a person. So I think that's interesting. His instinct was definitely to look for a person to revere. But then he realised there's nobody more attained than he was. So he then said that he would live revering and relying upon the Dharma. And the Dharma's got two meanings, hasn't it? It means the teachings of the Buddha, but it also means the truth itself. So it was in that second form that he meant he would live revering and relying on the truth itself, which in a way isn't separate from him anymore. When you become enlightened, kind of you are the Dharma and the Dharma is you. So we can't, again, take it totally literally, but it's, I think that's exactly right. Who does the shrine salute? Who does the Buddha salute? It's the Dharma itself. But I think, yes, as I say, it's surprising. It's you could say that we're getting a glimpse into, if we really take this on board, we're getting a glimpse into the enlightened mind. We can learn something from that sutta. We can learn something about the enlightened mind. That the enlightened mind is a worshipping mind.
Yeah.
The enlightened mind is a revering mind. Sounds like that chimes with you strongly.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
it does. And it shows that still somehow he was grateful.
Yes.
Whatever he achieved.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
after that, I don't know about this sutra, so he, each and every tree, he was and grateful to
yeah,
that
that's
tree
right.
because they sheltered him. And so
that's
it is
right.
something amazing to see that,
yeah.
like Buddha, who was enlightened,
yeah.
and still feel that.
Yeah, yeah.
And we are just human beings.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we go just and
right.
up in the cloud.
Yeah.
But to see him that,
yeah.
it gives us that strength. That you just.
Yeah.
Like you said that
yeah.
you are grateful to your teachers
yeah. Yeah.
when you bow them
yeah.
and see the Buddha doing that.
Yeah.
You know that
yeah.
thought came in
yeah.
to him.
Yeah.
So it is really,
yeah. Yeah.
really, for me, it's yeah, it is something very special to think
yeah,
about.
It's very special. I think you put it very well, and also you've given us a little bit more of the story that the Buddha well gazed at you know
yeah.
actually sat gazing
gazed.
At the tree
yeah.
which had sheltered him
yeah.
and then it said he went round all the different trees on the spot you know
yeah.
and you know for the you know that was part of the 7 weeks and I think again it completely connects with what I was saying about it showing us what the mind of enlightenment is like. It's
yeah,
a
exactly.
it's a worshipping mind, it's a grateful mind, it's a revering mind. It's kind of counterintuitive that, isn't it? Because you think, you would think that, you know, we are grateful to the Buddha, but it should be that way around,
yeah.
and it is that way around as well. Sometimes I think as well, thinking about my own kind of Dharma life, it's almost like the more you go along, the more you realise how amazing the Dharma is.
Exactly.
So, in a certain sense, only really a Buddha who can really understand what a gift the Dharma is.
Yeah.
So actually, again, that's, you almost become more grateful the more you realise, you know, what a huge thing. Well, actually, what a huge thing life is.
Mm.
You know, even take away this sort of word of the Dharma, you realise that more and more, not less and less. So your gratitude, actually, if you allow it, opens up. Yeah. Yes. Go on, ask them.
I wonder if there's a sense as well when you think of attainment. Aye. It's easy for us to think of a self attaining that.
Yes.
And actually, it seems there is a sense of a real humility.
Yeah.
And opening up to other things. And
Yeah.
And that's where the gratitude comes.
Yeah.
In, rather than.
Yeah.
I've attained this.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. I think that's an even deeper aspect of that. That's exactly right, because, as the Buddha's taught, what the Buddha's kind of great insight was, that actually our ordinary, unenlightened mind is always circling back to me, you know. So it's always how I've been recently sort of glossing it, is we're unenlightened, we're always circling back to what's in this for me, so there'll always be a sort of selfishness. And by the way, Buddhism doesn't blame us for that. It doesn't say that we're bad because we circle back to that. That's just what the unenlightened state is. So there's always like, what is it, what's in it for me? Or like, why is this happening to me? So a kind of aversive response, or what do people think of me? A sort of, you know, that sort of pride, you know, even if it's inverted pride. So unaligned, we always circle back to that, and that's painful.
Yeah.
It's painful, isn't it, to be, you know, what's in it for me, or, you know, why is this happening to me, or what do people think of me? That's painful. And when you, the more you can feel gratitude, sort of unalloyed, you know, just full-hearted gratitude, it kind of takes you out of me. It puts like this little me into a much bigger perspective. Which again, so, and you realise, yes, it's not sort of, it's not about me, you know. And I think we feel that in our ordinary lives, don't we, when we feel grateful. We're temporarily sort of released from that sort of tyranny of what's in it for me, or, you know, what people thinking of me, or so on. Can people get a little taste of that? I think it's quite good to realise that, you know, although enlightenment is, in one way, it's very, very different, it's completely different from anything we can imagine. In another way, we've all had like a glimpse. So every time we've had an experience of gratitude, inspiration, even reverence, even that sense of looking up to someone or to the Buddha, that takes you out of, puts me into perspective, instead of me being in the centre of everything, which causes us pain. It puts us into perspective. So I think you put it very, very well.
I still get really very caught up with the me, and so I tend to associate, like when I think of reverence, it conjures up religion and the worshipping of a superior being, and that necessarily has the dichotomy of, if there is a superior being, I am the inferior being, and I am inadequate, and I am inferior, and I am bad and wrong.
Mm.
And this figure that I look up to is right and good and white and perfect.
Mm.
And so the kind of the reverence conjures up this sort of dichotomy, which is sort of uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But gratitude to me, like, and I do experience gratitudes and I have glimpses like every day. Sometimes it's just like, I don't know, I see something and I really feel grateful for that.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of, I still see it doing in that sort of that light, because perhaps my gratitude is about like saying, oh wow, thank you for this.
Yeah.
And, you know, despite
yeah.
me not being perfect
yeah.
and
yeah.
not being,
yeah.
you know, like,
yeah.
thank you for that. It's kind of almost like being accepted for who
yeah.
you are
yeah.
with all your shortcomings
yeah.
and all
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think reverence to me is quite strongly associated, perhaps because I was brought up Catholic.
Yeah.
with the worshipping of a superior
yeah.
being who is much better than you, and you need to bow and
yeah.
just repent.
Well, and I think, if I might add something in theistic religions, and this being that you could never become.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think, because to me that's a crucial thing about the difference between a theistic religion and Buddhism. Because what's crucial about Buddhism, the teachings of the Dharma, is that we can all be enlightened
yeah, yeah.
in the way
yeah.
that, well, certainly also being brought up a Catholic, you could never become God.
Yeah, yeah,
there would always be that divide. So whereas in Buddhism, it's interesting because there is a tension, because there is a dichotomy when we think of ourselves and the Buddha, or even when I was just on retreat at Adhisthana, one of our retreat centres, and there was order members there who'd been ordained nearly as long as I was born, you know, and I could see that their practice was definitely further along than me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There was no doubt in my mind, you know, that they've been practicing all these years,
mm-hmm.
you know. So there definitely was a difference, you know, but I think so. It's how to create. I think there's an interesting art. How do we creatively hold that without then thinking, oh, I'm bad and rubbish and stuff,
mm-hmm.
to think, well, I can see they're further on. Actually, same, not just in religious life, like, I'm thinking of, particularly the art, you know, because I do, as rightly should I say, try to write poems. Now, I know that there's, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people that are better, you know, that I aspire, you know, I wish I could only have a fraction. How does one be able to recognise that? You know, I don't want to pull them down to my level, or that's another, you know, that would be like, it would make the world very, very small. But so how do I recognise that they're definitely more, you know, got more talent, got more, you know, than me, but at the same time, me not making myself feel bad about it, like having it as an inspiration. I think that's an art.
Mm.
It's kind of the anxiety of influence, really. But I think that is definitely, I think that it's important to always remind ourselves, well, if you know the threefold Puja, the Buddha was born as we are born,
yeah.
what the Buddha overcame, we too can overcome, what the Buddha attained, we too can attain, that we can be the Buddha, we can be enlightened, we can be an enlightened being. So it's not an unbridgeable gulf, you know, it's not that you've got like God here and human beings there, and that's forever different, yeah.
You can
yeah.
kind of almost revere the potential in yourself.
Yeah.
As well, if the idea of something
yeah.
out there is.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. I think when we're bowing, you know, to the refuge tree, bowing to the Buddha, I think we're bowing to that aspect of it's almost the Buddha principle, as well as the, you know, there's the historical Buddha that we're grateful to, like thank goodness he became enlightened and showed us the way. So there's that actual gratitude, but we're also bowing to the fact that human beings can become Buddha as well, and that means me as well, and you and everyone, you know. I think that's exactly what we're doing, we're bowing to that potential.
And altogether, like Buddha said, we all have those seeds.
Yes.
The goodness.
Yeah, yeah.
And we all experience that.
Yeah.
Whatever situation we are, whatever our
yeah.
lives are, but we have that goodness in
yeah,
us.
Yeah.
But sometimes we forget about that.
Yeah.
Because we are so wrapped up in our family's
life
and all these things.
Yeah.
But sometimes, like you said, time to time you will have that glimpses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
then you will realize that you are not you. you are just a part of this whole phenomena.
Yeah.
And that is something, such a liberation you will feel momentarily.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because due to your condition and habitual things, you will go back.
Yeah.
You will not like a Buddha that enlighten and
yeah.
carry on that.
Yeah.
But you feel that, that you will come out of that me.
Yeah.
And you will connect,
yeah,
and when,
yeah,
when you connect
things.
That and see that for a moment, and it is something really, you
yeah.
can't, and that's why you come again, though you go back again and again to your habits and
yeah.
whatever, but you will come again and again to dharma.
Yeah,
because
hope.
Those little
well, the seeds,
glimpses.
The glimpse, and I think a seed,
you know,
is, a seed is a
seeds,
very good, a
seed's
a
yeah.
very good image.
Yeah.
For a number of reasons, because it's got that whole sort of metaphor of growth. Oh, and so, and the Buddha, of course, did see humanity.
Yeah.
Now. His vision was a vision of lotuses.
Mm-hmm.
You remember, and some
yeah.
of the lotuses are, you know, still in the mud, and some are halfway up, and some are fully open. So we've all got that potential
mm-hmm.
for growth. I think a seed's a good image as well, because, like, in a certain sense, a seed's nothing like a lotus. But at the same time, they're completely connected,
yeah.
you know. But the seed could never imagine the lotus, you know, a bit like, and when we're talking about enlightenment as something unimaginable, it's both unimaginable
mm.
but natural, just
yeah.
as from the point of view of the seed, the lotus is unimaginable, but it's also completely natural.
Mm.
But I think the other reason it's good as well is because it shows, I think this seed is a good image for potential, because it shows that, that every seed has got the potential
yeah.
to become a lotus or a rose. Or, at the same time, it's not automatic.
No.
So it does need the conditions. Like if the seed isn't, if the seed
you
is just sort of flung on,
seed,
yeah, exactly.
The effort for
exactly,
that.
Exactly.
Yes.
If it's just
yeah.
thrown on like sort of stony ground or even given the wrong things, like too much water or something, it's not going to grow. So I think it's important to realise it's both it's natural, but it's not inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for all those reasons, the seed is a good image. Let's say a little bit more about this subject of reverence. How are we doing? Oh my goodness, the time always goes so fast. So we're talking about, you could say, in several levels so far. So the Buddha reveres the Dharma, the truth itself. The Buddha's disciples revere the Buddha's teaching, which is the same thing as the Buddha, really. The Dharma is the same as the Buddha. So there's those two levels. And then, in a way, you could say that the Buddha, say, like Vajrasattva at the very top would represent the Dharma. That kind of, you know, the almost the blue sky itself. So he's above the Buddha, yeah? I think that's represent, that you can see in a way that's, I'm just sort of thinking as I speak, but that's, I think that's representing who does the Buddha revere. So the Buddha, so Vajrasattva right at the top. I mean, you know, we've got to show him in like paint because it's a picture, but you can imagine like something like just shimmering, just like a sort of, I don't know, white like flame in the sky, just a shimmer. You know, Vajrasattva is like so fine, it would be like a shimmer, you know, nearly blue sky, but just a shimmer in the sky. So Vajrasattva is above the Buddha, so the Buddha's looking up to truth itself, so Vajrasattva is representing truth itself. But then, kind of in the front and below, you've got this lotus, and this is, what's this one at the front and below? Who's that representing?
Is it Sangharakshita?
Yeah, so that's
his teachers.
That's Sangharakshita and his
teachers,
yeah. So that's called the teachers of the present. And it really is the teachers of the present. Sangharakshita is still alive. It's even possible to still meet him, even though he's 92, he still like meets people when he's well enough. His teachers have all died, but he's, you know, they're in living memory, and many people, I don't know, did you ever meet any of them?
No.
But some people in our order have met some of those teachers. So they are the teachers of the present. So that's, you say that's another level of reverence. We can have reverence, gratitude to our own teachers, but both Buddhist teachers, but even in ordinary life, yeah. Like, you know, I love my poetry teacher. You know, I do feel sometimes I want her to be like, I don't know, garlanded with flowers. You know, she's just like, you know, such a wonderful teacher. So you've got the level of reverence of our own teachers, and that's, I definitely would describe that as a different kind of reverence. It's definitely, it's connected to these three levels, the Buddha revere and the Dharma, the Buddha's disciples, and, you know, which we might include ourselves in, as revering the Buddha, and then this level of ordinary teachers, you know, well, ordinary, extraordinary, but, you know, people we might even meet. That's like another level. And what I've been thinking about and exploring myself is that we need all of these levels. That if you, so here, see what you think of this. This is quite a sort of recent thought. But if, say you destroyed the symmetry of this tree and you took out the sort of higher lotuses and you were just, all you had was these teachers of the present, and that was all you had to sort of have gratitude and reverence towards. You didn't have, you know, you completely erased the Buddha and you completely erased Vajrasattva. I think it would go, what I've been exploring is that it would kind of start to go wrong, and I think it would become what some of you have sort of hinted at, and where reverence goes wrong. Because these people, extraordinary as they are, I mean, you know, we probably know something of Sangharaksha. Some of the other teachers, like Dardra Rinpoche, like, you know, really amazing. You know, people. At the same time, they are human beings. And no human being can sort of bear the weight, as it were, of like, if they were the only thing you were revering, it's, no human being could. It's too much for a human being, because it's true that you can't give them one's whole, your whole idealism can't go onto a human being. They can't bear the weight of that, because even an enlightened human being probably can't, in a sense, because they'll have a personality. They'll do things that we don't like, I don't know, read their own newspaper or something. You know, they'll have, at the very least, sort of foibles and things that don't, we kind of think, no, you know, how can I revere such and such a person? They, like, vote for the wrong political party, or they, read the wrong newspaper or whatever. Do you see what I mean? That's what I mean by no human being can bear the weight of the whole of our idealism. Is that sort of... But if we include the whole refuge tree, then we're all right, because in a way our idealism is for everything's in its proper place. So we can, our whole idealism, the Buddha can bear the weight of that, and Vajrasattva can bear the weight of that, because they are the ideal. They're the archetype, yeah? Am I? Yeah? So if we have the whole tree, then it can be, it's not that we want to portion it out, it's not so literal as that. The right amount of reverence, I don't even want to say a month, what am I trying to say? that one makes the other possible. Yeah.
Mm.
The Buddha's like a refuge. Yeah. Mm. So it can never. We can never come to the end of how much we can revere the Buddha and feel gratitude to the Buddha, because it's limitless, because they are limitless. So we can have unlimited, we never need to hold back.
Yeah.
So because that's in place, then we can have an appropriate amount of reverence and gratitude to human beings. Mm. Yeah. We're not trying to put an unrealistic amount onto a human being, but we can put our full with that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think of it in terms of, yeah, do ask me if that's not clear, because I don't know if I've explained it quite clearly.
Maybe I can put a bit in.
Yeah.
The man that ordained me is one of these people. I think Subhadra Mati was talking about. He's ordained 45 years ago at Solna, and he at times he really irritates me at Solna. But he always brings me back to the Buddha.
Yeah.
And a year ago, it was something I wrote to him and said, "Have you lost your faith?" And I just thought about it for 24 hours. I got back to him. No, I haven't. He was down in New Zealand, as he often goes in the winter working. And so it's something that fuels him in his daily life that gets transmitted, that was beyond him dropping this on my around my neck in 95. It's something that's always been. I very rarely see or have any communication with him, but he represents something that flows right through there.
I think flow is the operative word. It's like the teachers of the present are like a gateway that something can flow. Yeah. So without them, we wouldn't have access to the Buddha. But without the Buddha, the teachers wouldn't make sense, because they're just beaming. They might be very wonderful people, but it wouldn't make sense. Each makes sense of the other. And I think the same, so if we can't, what I'm sort of arguing or putting out, you can sort of go away and think, and you might not agree with me, but what I'm sort of putting out is that it's like revering at the highest level, like bowing to the Buddha, enables us to all feel gratitude, even reverence to our more ordinary, extraordinary teachers, because it's that they're in relationship to each other. You can't have one without the other. If you can't revere at that highest level, it'll start to all go a bit funny, because you'll try and load all that onto ordinary people and they can't sort of bear the weight of it. But I think if you only have it the other way round, if you think, okay, I'll feel reverence, I'll feel gratitude to the Buddha, but these people are, you know, these human beings with all their faults and failings, I'm not going to feel gratitude to them. I think the danger there is that it gets a bit abstract, it gets a bit removed, you know, that would be the danger the other way around. It gets it so that it's a bright idea, oh yes, there's these like wonderful Buddhas in the blue sky somewhere, but I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna listen to any ordinary human being, you know. So it's like each is a, maybe corrective isn't quite the right word, but each is a kind of, each type of relationship is helping us work with the other type of relationship. And I think, which I think goes back to like what you said right at the beginning, that this image is, there's a symmetry to this image. You can, if you lopped one bit of it off, it works as a whole, yeah? It works as a whole. I think that's probably going to, we're kind of out of time, so I might have to leave you to ponder on that. Just as, you know, at the beginning I was saying, these bodhisattvas and these arahants, they're in symmetry sort of horizontally. If you took one set, if you were just left with the historical figures, you'd feel like there was something missing. But if you just stayed with the archetype, there'd be something missing. So horizontally, it would be imbalanced. But I think like vertically, it would be if you took out the Buddha, it would be. If you took out Vajrasattva, it would be. And if you took out the teachers of the present, it would be that something about needing all of them. And if you have all of them, this becomes something that you can, it becomes a symbol of something that we can, in our own time, at our own pace, and think that we probably feel gratitude towards, but we might even feel reverence towards as a whole. So there's some things to think about. I hope that's kind of some food for thought. As I say, certainly no need to agree. You know, do come back next week with questions. I won't be here.
Thank you, Sabadramati. I'm glad gratitude's crept in. Kept coming up with Sabadramati and one or two others. Alok, who painted this image, he was ordained in 76, and he has gone very public over the years, and his gratitude to Sangharakshana, because he was a former heroin addict, and he said that without Sangharakshana, his life would have gone. Obviously, he would have followed, he always was an artist from a very young age, but he was a heroin addict, and without Sangharakshana, the Dharma, he's expressed gratitude. And I think that's important, that we keep gratitude also very much in perspective on a mundane level. Mm-hmm. When I cooked at Vajrasana recently on a weekend retreat, what you don't know, you all said thank you. What you'd never know, nobody's ever seen me do it, Vaya Vajranamra Pushpa know I do, is I go into the kitchen and I bow to the kitchen. Mm. And that is bowing to the LBC. Mm. Whenever I've had a solitary at Vajrasana in those huts, I bow to the bathroom, I bow to the kitchen, I bow to where the shrine is, I come out and I bow to the hut, I'm bound to the LBC and I'm bound to the Dharma. Mm.
And this is also for me, for present teacher, they are the one who gave us the way. Mm. Who gave us the path. Mm. So it's very important to, and teachers, yeah. Mm. Exactly, otherwise we would not have known that, who is Buddha, what is the path, exactly. And what is, how we are going to practice in our life. So they are really important also. Yeah. Yeah. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Sabadramati's book is still for sale. It's through Windhorse.
No, thank you.
Right, thank you very much.
Yeah, but thank you very, very much for having me. Yeah.